Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee for this Thursday, February 4th, 2021. My name is Frank Hornstein. I'm the chair of the committee. We will start our meeting with the call of the roll. Mr. Dodge, members just simply say present after your name is called. Mr. Dodge.
Chair Hornstein.
Present.
Vice Chair Cagle.
Present.
Representative Petersburg.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Present.
Representative Bernardi.
Present.
Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hausman.
Present.
Representative Heinrich.
Present.
Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Representative Mason.
Present.
Representative Murphy.
Murphy, present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Torkelson.
Present.
Representative West.
Here.
There is a quorum.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dodge. Our next item of business is approval of our minutes from February 2nd, 2021. Representative Petersburg, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the approval of the minutes of February 2nd.
Okay, the motion before us is moval of the February 2nd minutes. Members, this will be a voice vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Members, today's hearing, we're going to continue the discussion that we started on Tuesday related to equity in transportation. And I just wanted to note that today is, as I mentioned on Tuesday, today is the birthday of Rosa Parks, who is a giant in American history. And of course, her action in Montgomery in 1955 has a lot to do with the topic today of equity in transportation. And I wanted to just frame today's discussion with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr., who said that urban transit systems in most American cities have become a genuine civil rights issue because the layout of rapid transit systems determines the accessibility of jobs. So there is that nexus between transportation, jobs, and equity, and we'll be talking about that with a variety of different folks here in the next hour, and then at 2 o'clock or so, we'll take on House File 336 from Representative Jamie Becker Finn. So with that, I would like to invite our first guest. We have Mr. Steve Belton from the Twin Cities Urban League, who will present information and his perspective on kind of the jobs and transportation and job training nexus. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Belton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please state your name for the record. Sorry, Mr. Belton. Please state your name for the record and welcome.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein, members of the committee. I'm Stephen, President and Chief Executive of the Twin Cities. And joining me virtually today, seated virtually, my colleague Norma Miller, who is a job developer at the Urban League. I've been able to share with you some observations and experiences of transportation inequity. And if we have time, I would offer a few ideas for addressing. But first, a little context, if I may. Urban Cities was, until January 2020, known as the Minneapolis Urban League. We are a 95-year-old civil rights organization and an affiliate of the National Urban League, which was incorporated in 1910, so it's 111 years old. Our mission here at the Urban League Twin Cities is to serve as relentless and unapologetic advocates for equity, justice, and power for African descendants in the Twin Cities. We operate programs in workforce and training, home ownership, education, civic engagement, and policy development and advocacy. We serve anyone who seeks our help, but our focus is on the Black community and Black residents in the metro area. My comments today and those of Ms. Miller will focus on employment inequities in the transportation sector. But I would be remiss if I did not begin by pointing out that transportation inequities more broadly are very deep and ingrained in Minnesota, particularly in the metropolitan area. African descendants and BIPOC people are substantially more dependent, is one example, on public transit than white people. In 2019, the Minnesota Department of Health reported that 31% of African American and 25% Somali households did not have a motor vehicle versus 6% of white households. In other words, African descendants are up to 5 times more likely than whites to live in a home that does not have an automobile. Why is that important? Well, to quote from that same MDH report, in both the Twin Cities and Greater Minnesota, transportation is key to all of our daily activities. We use it to access our food, healthcare services, our connections to family, friends, and faith communities. Transportation connects the people, natural resources, and businesses within the state to each other and to markets and resources outside the state and country. Improves education and job security, strengthens social connections, supports mental health, and provides access to recreation. Additionally, the report continues, transportation provides women and mothers with the ability to access prenatal care, bring their children to childcare, attend school, and maintain employment. In Minnesota, 8% of women who did not receive prenatal care as early as they wanted reported having no transportation was a contributing factor. So transportation is vital. Transit is an essential indicator of well-being. And inequities in transit in the transportation sector disproportionately harm Black and poor people who themselves are disproportionately dependent on public transportation. So let me turn to employment inequities in the transportation sector. In a typical year, Minnesota spends about $4 billion on transportation, construction, and repairs. That's state and federal monies combined. That spending generates between 10,000 and 18,000 jobs per $1 billion spent, or between 40,000 and 72,000 jobs per year. The obvious question for me is how many of those jobs are going to Blacks and what percentage of the workforce in the transportation sector is diverse? A snapshot of construction labor from the Department of Labor and Industry for January 13, 2021, as an example, showed there was a total of 2,725 craft labor jobs or craft laborers at work as of that day. 2,725, of which 2,201 were white, 180 were Black. At that same time, same report, again, January 13, 2021, there were 332 operating engineers. Those are the folks who operate cranes, earth movers, and heavy machinery. Of that 332, 298 were white, 11 were Black. Now, this committee has resources at its disposal, can provide far better data and more data disaggregated by race. But I can tell you anecdotally, and from the vantage point of our experience as an organization that recruits and trains and places African Americans, the numbers are woefully inadequate. And I would just invite you to keep an eye, as I do, on the many transportation construction sites in the metropolitan area and in Greater Minnesota to see if you can spot any people of color operating machinery or performing skilled or general labor. I guarantee that if you see someone of color working a construction site, it probably will surprise you as it does me. And more often than not, that will be the only person of color on that work site. Blacks comprise 6% of the state population, nearly 12% of Ramsey County's population, and 13.3% of Hennepin County. But the percentage of Blacks in construction and jobs generally does not approximate those percentages. The problem of employment inequity in transportation is complex. It involves the state and local governments in their commitment to establishing and enforcing hiring goals, the trade unions and employers and their commitments or lack of commitment to diversity, equity, inclusion. It involves the education, health, and housing disparities in Black and OIM communities, just to name a few of the factors. But I have to say, and if there's any good news in what I'm saying, is that this problem is not intractable. This is not rocket science. Let me offer one program model that previously was funded by MnDOT, which some of you may be familiar with. In 2010, and for about 5 years thereafter, the Urban League ran a program called Big Step, which was funded by a grant from MnDOT. In its first year alone, and I have to tell you that this preceded my time. I've been at the helm of the Urban League and have been at the Urban League for only 5 years. So this is 2010. But in its first year, we recruited 200 persons from the community to attend orientation sessions about highway heavy construction jobs. 200. The orientation included a two-week work readiness skills training program, of which 56 of the 200 completed. The remaining 144 dropped out for various reasons. They could include just life got in the way, transportation challenges, disinterest in construction jobs, or interest in something else. But 56 completed the orientation. 19 of the 56 completed 284 hours each of union-provided industry sector training, of which 16 of those 19 were placed for employment at 13 different companies. Now, you might say that 13 out of an original 200 sounds like it wasn't a success. I would argue that if you look at the data in general about what it takes to recruit and sustain and to actually place the number of people, that actually is a success. More importantly, I invite you to do the math. These union jobs typically pay in excess of $2 or $20 an hour. Many of them start at $30 an hour. And do the annual wages of, 16 people at those wage rates over a year's period of time. That is a substantial dollar amount in an investment in the Black community. The model worked. The challenge we have had sustaining funding for programs like that and sustaining it over the undulations that occur in the economy, over the challenges of the complexities of living in Black communities. I'm going to turn this over now, if I may, for just a moment, Mr. Chair, to Norma Miller, invite her to share just a few quick remarks from her perspective as a job developer. Ms. Miller is, I believe she is the first, if not the first, she is one of the few African-American journey people who's a card-carrying member of the Painters Union. So if Ms. Miller could come on the chair, I'd like to turn it over to her.
Thank you, Mr. Belton. Ms. Miller, thank you so much for coming today. Please state your name for our record.
Norma Miller.
And you can proceed with your testimony.
Okay. I'm the first African-American woman to retire as a union painter in the Twin Cities after serving more than 20 years in that particular trade. As a pioneer in the trades, it is my obligation to further the careers and initiative that would facilitate apprentices, journey people, not only resignate, but well standing in their community. As Mr. Belton spoke about, sometimes you just see one person of color on these particular sites. I was often the only African-American woman on these sites because I was the only woman in the trade, the African-American woman in the trade. Highway heavy consists of several trades such as laborers, operating engineers, the carpenters, cement masons, and the teamsters. It's important to have well-trained people from the community to be represented on these jobs. These are highways well-traveled by us, but it's obvious that not enough minorities are seen in construction on these sites. We're underrepresented in the transportation process. Our goal is to get more people into the pathways, pre-apprenticeship programs with the different trades that represent highway heavy. We should and need to have more contractors open to hiring people from the underrepresented communities, making it more diverse if this is their objective. the barriers that I have encountered placing people, contractors want people with experience, even though they have completed the pre-apprenticeship training. Many contractors are not willing to examine these workforce culture and change when these biases are seen. Then some of the barriers also are transportation, driver's license, clothing, different barriers like that are in the way of having our people to move forward. I have been working as a job developer with the Urban League now since 2017. I think that's it that I have.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Really appreciate your testimony and Mr. Belton's testimony. Members, we did have another individual that was going to testify on this issue of jobs and transportation. I don't believe he's with us now, but I would like to use this, and when Mr. Staples comes, we'll take his testimony, but I'd like to use this opportunity to see if there are any questions of the committee for either Ms. Miller or Mr. Belton. Okay, I don't see any. I will thank both of you so much.
Welcome.
Go ahead. Is this, I hear someone here? Okay, no. All right, I appreciate it so much that both of you came, and I think that the program you mentioned, Mr. Belton, at MnDOT does seem like something we should be revisiting and looking at and seeing if it can be replicated perhaps in a new way. You know, let's look at some models that have succeeded in the past or others that can succeed in the future. But you've really identified a critical issue for us, and we will be looking at ways to address it. So thank you so much, both of you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Members, we will move on now to a panel of three local elected officials who will be joining us, and very, very happy that they could take time out of their busy schedules to be with us today. Our first guest is Councilmember Mitra Jalali from the City of St. Paul. Welcome to the committee, Councilmember Jalali, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Mitra Jalali.
You can proceed with your testimony, Councilmember Jalali.
Thank you. Chair Hornstein, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Mitra Jalali, and I am tremendously proud to represent the Midway and a large portion of other neighborhoods along the Green Line and I-94 as the Ward 4 council member for the City of St. Paul. In my work as a council member, I have come to see firsthand how our state's future depends on significant investment in climate action and racial equity through forward-thinking transportation policy. Fossil fuels burned in our transportation sector and the entrenched systems that support that are not only one of the biggest sources of pollution in Minnesota, in the air we breathe and depend on, but also a huge driver of inequality. It is tempting to believe that racial discrimination in transportation policy is a thing of the past, but it isn't. As you've already heard in detail on Tuesday and just now, the initial injustice of deliberately routing I-94 through one of our state's most prominent Black neighborhoods in the Rondo community has had a multi-generational impact, destroying Black wealth, Black businesses, and displacing a large population of Black Minnesotans, the effects of which are still felt today. But we also can't forget about the second ongoing crime, that everyone still remaining along the corridor is disproportionately exposed to pollution from the freeway and has been for decades. Analysis by the Minnesota Department of Health has shown this pollution leads to increased cases of asthma in children and increased cases of heart and lung problems that have been directly tied to increased particulates and ground level ozone as the freeway kicks up asphalt, glass, and other materials, and it goes into the lungs of the children of our state. To expand freeways now, as Minnesota has continued to do in recent years, will not only do nothing to address these problems, it will actually encourage more traffic, more pollution, and more damage to public health through induced demand and perpetuating status quo investments. And we also know that highway expansions exacerbate the global climate crisis, which again disproportionately affects communities of color, both here in St. Paul, also in Minnesota, and our very country and world. The state's most recent emissions inventory showed that transportation emissions have barely changed for more than a decade, but we can't expect them to change or even decrease if we don't first change the way our transportation system works. The City of St. Paul's Climate Action Plan reflects these realities through a focus on increasing denser, more sustainable development and expansion of public transit. And through this focus, we take aim at reducing the two greatest areas of emissions citywide and in most built environments, our buildings and car travel on our roads, which combined make up the vast majority of all emissions in St. Paul. Our City Council also unanimously passed this week a resolution expressing our priorities to MnDOT for the future of I-94, rejecting highway expansion, prioritizing transit expansion, and guaranteeing community benefits and community engagement for the BIPOC residents in neighborhoods across the corridor. These citywide plans and priorities have been driven by massive multiracial coalitions of residents in our capital city who believe in our shared future. I'm very grateful for your efforts to fight for the transportation policy and investments that we need as a state in our future. Electric vehicles can help reduce tailpipe emissions, but exchanging every gas car for an electric one can't be anywhere close to the whole strategy. As a basic way of life, people need and deserve to be able to safely move through our community on high quality sidewalks, trails, and transit. And as we look at corridors like 94 in particular, prioritizing racial equity through transit equity must be the first thing Minnesota does, not an afterthought. From cities like mine across the state to statewide leaders like members of this committee, let's make transit equity a clear priority. Thank you so much for your time and your work.
Thank you so much, council member. I will, if you can stick around, I don't know if you can stick around for a couple of minutes, we'll hear from Mayor Mike Elliott, and then if there's some questions for either of you, we'll take a break for that.
Happy to, thank you.
We got a potential other county commissioner, but I think she may have a conflict now, but we'll at least have questions for our two local elected officials. Our next testifier is the mayor of Brooklyn Center, Mayor Mike Elliott. Mayor Elliott, thank you so much for attending our hearing. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And unmute, please, if you can. Thank you, Mayor.
All right. Well, my name is Mike Elliott. I'm the mayor of Brooklyn Center.
Now you can proceed with your testimony.
All right. So thank you very much, committee, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this opportunity to be here with you today. I represent the City of Brooklyn Center, and I want to speak for a second about the proposed additional traffic lanes for Highway 94, for the Highway 94 project and 252, which goes through Brooklyn Center, North Minneapolis. It is adjacent to communities that have about 60% of residents being people of color, and at least 40% having incomes less than 185% of the federal poverty threshold. As you've heard on Tuesday, the impact of highways through communities of color have been well documented. The Health Effects Institute has found increased exposure to traffic pollution to be linked to higher rates of childhood asthma attacks, impaired lung function, and event premature death. Minnesota Department of Health data shows that my community has among the highest levels of childhood asthma hospitalization and emergency room visit rates. With those levels of respiratory illness, it's no surprise that we have been number one and consistently in the top five of COVID-19 contraction rates. Residents along highways have long been subject to disproportionate pollution and environmental injustice. Another well-documented fact is that highway expansions induce driving. We should not be planning and building more highway lanes, which increase traffic and pollution while diminishing traffic transit. If we are concerned about capacity of our roads, and we are, then building infrastructure for clean, convenient, and fast options for Minnesotans like bus rapid transit should be the first thing that MnDOT proposes in every metro project, not the last thing that MnDOT pushes to do by local government units. If your funding streams can be used for wider roads and not used to fund bus rapid transit, then those funding streams are broken and need to be fixed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mayor Elliott. And we did have one more speaker, but I think she has another conflict now. But so we'll pause for any questions or comments related to Mayor Elliott and Councilmember Jalali's testimony. And I will scan here the committee, and I do not see any questions for either of you, but we very much appreciate your testimony and your presence and testifying on the record. And you know, this the issues that you brought up, we also examined on Tuesday, and I think you know, the whole issue of 94 is going to be critical. But of course, there's other freeways, as Representative Petersburg pointed out, that I think had some similar history. 35W heading south from Minneapolis. We even have it some on 35E. Even looking at the history of I-35 in Duluth, when it was built and expanded, there are some equity issues there as well. So this is a statewide issue, and one that you know, we will be examining moving forward, particularly as we look at transit and transit funding. And Mayor, to both of you, I think, you know, the arterial bus rapid transit proposals, I think, that are being developed by the Met Council are particularly important. So I appreciate very much your taking time out of your busy schedules to be with us, and we look forward to keeping in contact with you as the session progresses. So thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council Member. Very much appreciated. So members, we will now move on to our next panel. And again, we had a couple of testifiers that were not able to make it. If they are able to, we will accommodate them. But we now have our next guest is Tawana Black, and she is the founder and CEO of the Center for Economic Inclusion. So Ms. Black, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Tawana Black.
Great. You can proceed with your testimony, Ms. Black.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein and members of the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee. I thank you for the opportunity to join you this afternoon and to share a bit about our work. At the Center for Economic Inclusion, we are leading the region and, in fact, organizations and institutions across the country in closing historic and current racial income, employment, and wealth gaps by equipping policymakers, government agencies, and employers with the knowledge, skills, resources, and tools necessary to dismantle institutional racism and accelerate an economy that truly works for everyone. The economic imperative to do so has never been greater, and the economic opportunity has also never been greater. Advancing an inclusive economy is an economic imperative that has never been more critical today. As McKinsey's data recently illustrated, closing the U.S. racial wealth gap could lead to more than $1 to $1.5 trillion added to our U.S. GDP per year. That relates to more than 4 to 6% increase by 2028 if we begin taking meaningful, measurable steps within both our public sector, where you have the opportunity to create meaningful change, and our private sector, where we drive meaningful change every day with employers across the state of Minnesota and the country. Only the full economic participation by Black, Indigenous, Asian, and Latinx workers will fully unlock our state's economic potential for growth. Driving per capita income parity would add more than $32 billion in regional GDP just here in Minneapolis-St. Paul, something we can't forget to take full advantage of. On today, Transit Equity Day, our call to action and opportunity to this committee is to invest more deeply and more meaningfully in regional and statewide racially equitable transit and transportation opportunity, because neighborhoods with higher transit dependent rates can access employment at job centers in a reasonable commute time, and this is good for our entire economy. Just moments ago, the Center for Economic Inclusion concluded a forum with almost 300 attendees from across the region, the state, and the country, focused on reckoning with transit equity, where we address the very topics that have just been illustrated by Mayor Elliott, Commissioner Jalali, Councilmember Jalali, and Mr. Belton and others, relative to the economic opportunity that we must embrace as a state by centering racially equitable opportunities in our transportation investments and the simultaneous need to mitigate the disparate impacts to low wealth and Black and Indigenous and Latinx and Asian communities as we make investments to expand our transportation and transit options. We come as both a partner and an instigator and advocate for more equitable investments, investments that do not only benefit workers and job seekers, but also benefit employers in our entire states. We come as an advocate encouraging you to center the very populations who have been excluded from our state's economy for far too long, which requires hearing their voices, valuing the data of their own experiences as much as we value the data that we have within our state's institutions, recognizing that transit-dependent workers are often caught between a rock and a hard place, recognizing that they are qualified for jobs that are not near their homes and yet have no valuable and meaningful way to be able to access those jobs. And employers are caught in similar challenges, recognizing that transportation, childcare, and affordable, meaningful housing have been the mainstays as barriers to accessing talented workers for far too long in our state, the true impetus for a spatial mismatch and a skills mismatch. To that end, our state, with your great leadership, has an opportunity to move the needle on effective, reliable, and affordable transportation and transit investments, opportunities that are done by using data, responding to the market, and centering Black, Indigenous, Asian, and Latinx communities, doing so not in spite of the diversity of our communities and our state, but doing so recognizing that when we center those populations, using the data at our fingertips, we will grow our entire state's economy. We look forward at the Center for Economic Inclusion to continuing to partner with you, leveraging the investments that are being made alongside the employers in the state and the data at our reach to grow our economy and to do so in a way that is truly equitable and in our state's best interest. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you so much, Ms. Black. And I wanted to just, there were a couple things you said that I just wanted to make to highlight. I mean, I think your comments about frontline workers and transit are particularly timely, you know, as we have found out during this pandemic that frontline workers have been literally keeping all of us alive, and they are especially dependent on transit. So those healthcare workers, the grocery store workers, the janitors, you know, they're riding transit still, even through this pandemic. And it's especially important. So I appreciate you highlighting that. And, you know, I did mention Rosa Parks' birthday, but I may have failed to mention at the beginning that, as you referred to, this is a day set aside to talk about transportation equity. There are a number of public agencies around the country, community organizations, labor organizations, that for several years now have designated today as National Transit Equity Day. So thank you so much for that. And if you can stick around, we're going to hear from Ms. Watts and Mr. Frempong Longden, and then we'll take some questions from the committee for all three of you. So our next testifier is Ms. Janice Watts from Fresh Energy. Ms. Watts, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Janice Watts. Hello.
You can proceed, Ms. Watts.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein and members of the committee for having me here today. Again, my name is Janice Watts. I am a Senior Policy Associate at Fresh Energy, a renewable energy policy nonprofit based in St. Paul. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I am a lifelong resident of St. Paul and have grown up here as a public transit rider. I am here to talk about the importance of transit investment, and in this time of great humanitarian and ecological crises, the commitment to a society that is sustained by justice is really necessary and demanded. So as Chair Hornstein just mentioned, today is Transit Equity Day, a day that celebrates the birthday of iconic civil rights freedom fighter and public transit rider Rosa Parks. And as her legacy deserves to live on in the American consciousness, so do the legacies of many freedom fighters that acted for justice. So whenever I think about Rosa Parks and the incredible contribution she made to the movement for civil rights through the bus boycotts, I also think about Claudette Colvin, who was a 15-year-old teenager who also lived in Montgomery, Alabama, and who also refused to give her seat on a bus to a white woman on March 2nd, 1955. That was 9 months before the bus boycotts began. So Claudette Colvin was dragged off that bus by white police officers, handcuffed and thrown in jail for asserting her civil rights to public transit. Both Rosa Parks and Claudette Colvin understood that their right to travel on public transit was about more than just a seat. It was about the freedom to travel, unrestricted by someone else's bias. And the outcomes of the freedom to travel is about living a fulfilled and independent life, regardless of your ethnicity, gender, class, disability, age, or geographic location. In Minnesota, the transportation sector, as you heard, is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, pollution that is causing changes to our climate and severe public health impacts, especially on respiratory and mental health. The COVID-19 pandemic has been devastating to communities of color that have already suffered under decades of a healthcare system that's been full of racial and economic disparities, coupled with long-term exposure to pollution like PM2.5. And largely, as we just heard, again, it is the BIPOC communities that are the essential workers in healthcare and in food service, in delivery and retail, that rely on public transit to keep our economy going in this extraordinarily tough time we're all living in. So we have the opportunity to upgrade our transportation systems and meet the modern era. Electrification of Metro Transit buses has been underway, but it has passed time that electric buses replace all diesel buses in the metro area and in rural Minnesota. School buses that transport our children and young people that are experiencing firsthand the impacts of climate chaos, the COVID-19 pandemic, and direct harms of white supremacy are calling for action from all of us. Funding public transit that is safe for riders and drivers, free from harassment and harm, clean for public health and the environment by being pollution and carbon free, and public transit that is affordable and accessible to all people in all places is one important action that can be done to address these compounding crises. These demands can be met with increasing investment in public transit, and surely there is precedent for this. There are many improvements that have been made to our transit systems, no doubt thanks to the funding and advocacy that has been invested over the years. But members, you all have the power to ensure that the next generation of Minnesotans have the freedom to travel in a safe, clean, and efficient manner, and that our existing transit infrastructure does not crumble in hopefully this temporary pause due to the COVID-19 pandemic that some of us, like myself, have taken from utilizing public transit. March 2020 was the last time I took public transit, even though I rely on public transit up until that point, but because of the pandemic, that was the last time I took public transit, but I'm still advocating to upgrade our transit systems and invest and use this moment to invest in public transit. And when I say public transit, I'm talking about bus rapid transit, as we've heard about, light rail, suburban, rural, and tribal transit systems, and infrastructure for multimodal mobility like land bridges and bike, walk, and rural trails that create connections to opportunities and to one another. Again, you've all been hearing about the impacts that the last 70 or so plus years of transportation policy, planning, and development have had on many communities around our state. So every day is an opportunity to right those wrongs of the policies that were decided in a framework of racism and social exclusion. So committing to an investment in public transit that is grounded in the understanding of history will lead to better outcomes for access to opportunities, for cleaner air, for healthier climate, and environmental justice. So thank you, Chair Hornstein and members of the committee, for your time and for inviting me here to give my testimony. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ms. Watts, and I really appreciated your testimony. I think particularly what you said there at the end, that policies that are grounded in and informed by history, I think is a very, very important statement. And I think, we've had a number of speakers over this last week remind us of. And I also like your phrase, freedom to travel. I think that's also a very important frame as we look at the freedom to travel for everybody. And so thank you so much for your work and for your testimony. We are joined by Mr. Jamez Staples at this time. And, you know, Mr. Staples has done remarkable work at Renewable Energy Partners, where he is the CEO. And I think he's just done a masterful job, I think, in a number of different forums that I've seen him in making the connection between jobs and transit. And so I appreciate his presence with us tonight, this afternoon. Mr. Staples, welcome to the House Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Jamez Staples, Renewable Energy Partners. I'm the CEO of Renewable Energy Partners. First and foremost, thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the importance of transit. We at Renewable Energy Partners, we are in the solar energy business, and then I also have a company, Northgate Development. And the reason why Northgate Development even exists is as a result of the need for training in the urban core of North Minneapolis. And so we are developing this training center on the 5 line, which has been now transitioning to the D line, which is a $75 million bus rapid transit infrastructure improvement that will run all the way from Brooklyn Center through Minneapolis, so through Richfield and to Bloomington, that will provide a necessary component of transit that will give people access to the training that's necessary to help deploy some of the clean energy infrastructure that needs to be happening when we're talking about environmental justice. Without getting the necessary access to training, you know, we don't have a workforce. And if we don't have a workforce, we can't deploy any of these things, as I heard some of the other commenters talk about, you know, the essential workers and things of that nature. So what we're seeking to do here is utilize this public infrastructure as a key component to make sure that everyone has access to participate in the economy. So and the clean energy sector, you know, it's growing, it's big. And so I just left from, and if excuse me, I'm in my car, because I'm just left from my office at 1200 Plymouth, where we're looking at, as we talked about, multimodal transit. We have bike lanes out front, protected bike lanes. We also have electric vehicle charging stations that we're deploying on site, in addition to the electric vehicles that will be electric vehicle hubs that will be there on site for electrification, that will be shared vehicles. So I just think it's important that transit, it happens. You know, it's absolutely imperative. And where we sit 5 minutes from the blue line and the green line, which is at the Twin Stadium, which creates that east-west connector in north and south. So I'll just limit my comments there. I appreciate you guys taking the time and allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much, Mr. Staples. And again, I always appreciated the excellent work you do and the excellent way that you have been able to, you know, connect the dots between, you know, jobs and transit and prosperity. So thank you for bringing that vision to our committee. We have one more testifier, and then we can get to some questions for the testifiers that we've had here over the last few minutes. So the last person on this panel is Charles Frambong Longden. He's with the Sierra Club. And Mr. Frambong Longden will make some comments. And then here is one of the, you know, there aren't a lot of advantages to the Zoom era, but one of them is that people who aren't able to make our meetings can testify via video. And Mr. Frambong Longden has a video he will share with us, that includes some voices that we haven't heard yet today. So Mr. Frambong Longden, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And then I think after your testimony, you can cue the video that you have for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Charles Frambong Longden Jr. Thank you, Chair Hornstein and committee members, for allowing me the space to testify here today on Transit Equity Day. My name is Charles Frempon London, Jr., and as an environmental justice organizer for the 80,000 members of the Sierra Club North Star chapter, I talk with people across the state who care about climate change and equity. I read policies which include all the right words and progressive phrases, but seldom do I see the real-world impact of these words. Why? Because the budget has nothing to do with equity and climate. So let's talk about the money then. The House deserves credit for approving a serious transit funding proposal in 2019, which included a half-cent metro sales tax to build on bus rapid transit network. While not enough to address climate change, it's a serious start and consistent with Governor Dayton's half-cent and 3/4-cent tax passed by Senate. Unfortunately, we have seen a collapse in gubernatorial leadership on transit. 2 years ago, Governor Walz proposed a mere 1/8-cent tax, a 75% reduction from his predecessor. Did equity and climate change become 75% less important in 2 years? And now Governor Walz's budget includes little for climate and nothing for transit, absolutely nothing. Minnesotans who care about climate and equity must once again rely on you, the House, to show leadership. We strongly support clean cars and electrification, but there's no data to suggest that we can possibly address transportation emissions through electrification alone. We need clean transportation options for all, like transit. Lastly, please remember this. New revenue for transit does not have to go with the gas tax for roads. It's not written anywhere. It's not a law. It's just a habit. The climate and equity crisis demand that we break bad habits. Fund transit now to address both climate change and equity. We have no time to waste. And like Chair Hornstein said, I will now leave you with a video testimony from some real Minnesotans.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Hi, my name is Anne, and I'm an employment counselor in the western suburbs where public transportation is often scarce. Every day I see individual need for affordable public transit to make job opportunity more accessible and equitable. For example, a straightforward 10-minute drive may be an hour and a half bus ride and only at certain times if it exists. Increased public transportation options are critical to our communities and individuals' economic well-being.
Hi, my name is Thomas, and to me, transit equity means that everyone is able to travel safely and accessibly. Whether you choose to ride transit, bike, walk, use a wheelchair, or even drive a car, and no matter what level of privilege you have, we should design public spaces to keep folks physically safe, use public safety resources to create safe conditions and treat people with dignity instead of focusing on punishment, and create geographical coverage and trip frequencies that extend these benefits to everyone, not just the wealthiest neighborhoods. In a just and equitable future, nobody should have to ask if you have access to reliable transportation at a job interview, because you should have the right to get where you need to be.
My name is Emily. I live in Minneapolis, and I mainly get around the city by walking and biking. Despite living in the largest city in the state, it can be pretty difficult to get around without a car sometimes. Oftentimes, sidewalks are narrow and come pretty close to the road. In the winter especially, they can be pretty treacherous with ice and snow, and also cars don't pay attention to pedestrians at crossings always, leading to some pretty close calls. I've also had some close encounters with cars when I'm biking out on the street, either because cars don't respect sharing the road or because they're impinging on the bike lane space. I really appreciate the one-time bonding money that went to fund the Metro B&D bus rapid transit lines last year. This is a really important step, but we need consistent funding for reliable, frequent transit for everyone now. This transit needs to work for everyone. People like me, people who can't drive. Let's stop delaying and fund transit now.
Hi, my name's Becky and I live in Minneapolis, and I think we need better transit in Minnesota because we need fewer cars on the roads. Cars are huge emitters of the greenhouse gases that contribute to the climate change that is destroying our planet. Car infrastructure like highways and parking garages take up valuable land that could be better used for housing, parks, trails, etc. Cars are also incredibly expensive to purchase and maintain. Building out a robust, equitable transit system could give people the freedom to ditch their cars, spend their money on more important things like housing, like medical care, like food, and their families. Minnesota needs a 21st century transit system because we need to start cleaning up our planet, and that goes hand in hand with getting people out of their cars.
My name is Mark. What transit equity means to me is people having the option to get where they want to go the way they want to get there. If you've ever been a young adult who's never owned a vehicle or a car, and you've had to rely on, you know, family members or other people to get you where you need to go or where you want to go, you know exactly what it means to be a kid who really just doesn't have any other options as to your means or mode of travel. And honestly, Metro Transit and the transit system is heavily used by young adults, young folks going to school, going to friends, going to other places. And it's only growing. And if we ever want to be able to meet the need or the demand for more better transit, we need to start investing now. And so I highly, highly recommend that we all gather together to start advocating for better transit collectively, because we need that.
Hi, my name is Zoe.
Hi, my name is Sage.
And we speak for the buses.
Kids need transit too.
Let's fund transit now.
Yay!
Accessible and affordable public transit
is a civil right.
Let's invest now for transit options for all.
Thank you very much for that video and for your testimony. Mr. Fremdung Longden, and I wanted to see if there, we got a round of applause from Representative Mary Murphy. Members, we have a couple of minutes here if there are any questions for either Mr. Frempong Longden, Mr. Staples, Ms. Watts, or Ms. Black. So if there are any questions, I will scan our participant list. Quickly here, questions, comments, I see none. So thank you so much, all of you, for your testimony and you know, participating in our committee today. And we will be, you know, developing a bill here in the next 6 weeks or so, 6 to 8 weeks. And, you know, I envision a bill that will be inclusive of the entire state and all modes of transportation, and you know, ensuring that there is equity for all Minnesotans. It's the kind of vision that a friend and mentor of mine, Representative Bernie Leader, who passed, I think, the very substantial transportation bill in 2008. That was his vision. All parts of the state covered, all modes covered, access and accessibility for all. And I appreciate all of you bringing that vision to our committee today. So thank you so much. And members, we will now transition to our bill that we will be hearing this afternoon. And I am very happy to welcome Representative Jamie Becker Finn to our committee. And I believe that the bill that she has today, House File 336, is also a way to talk about equity in transportation. And she will explain why. And this bill, you know, relating to driver's licenses and revocations is important. We have heard this bill in the past, members. It has had a Republican lead author at one time. It has had a Democratic lead author. It is one of the, you know, I don't know, Representative Becker Finn, if this may be one of the only bills in the country that is supported by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, as well as the Southern Poverty Law Center. You know, so there is a lot of bipartisan support, and I think people who would consider themselves conservatives and liberals and others would support this bill. So we're going, what we're going to do, members, is I will move that House File 336 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety. We will have Representative Becker Finn offer her introduction and comments about the bill. She has a couple of testifiers. Then we will get into a conversation about the fiscal note for this bill. We'll have member questions and discussion. And it's my intention then, before we adjourn, to move this bill on to public safety. Representative Becker Finn, welcome to the committee. It's great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an author's amendment, and that addressed a concern that in the way that the legislative process is supposed to work that was brought to our attention. And I don't know if you want to move that now or you want to do it after the testimony.
Let's get the bill in the shape that you as the author would like to have our committee take a look at it in. Why don't you, Representative Becker Finn, Chair Becker Finn, explain your oral amendment and we'll adopt it.
I think it's the A4 amendment. I think we met deadline in getting that in. Maybe I'm mistaken.
Does everyone have a copy of the A4 before
yes.
you? Okay.
Yes.
Thank
Frank,
you.
Frank, did we move Frank?
This is Representative Nelson. Yeah, I'll move the A4 amendment.
Did we move the bill, original bill?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
Representative Chair Becker Finn.
Yep. So the A4 amendment, essentially, it was brought to our attention that there was an impact on some federal funds, and we just wanted to make sure that we were. It has to do with the non-resident violator compact, which was not a compact I was even aware of previously, but this language would help the bill so it's still in compliance with those requirements and so that we are not missing out on the chance of those federal dollars. So not controversial, just cleaning some stuff up.
Members, we're going to take a voice vote to incorporate the A4 amendment, which has been moved into the bill. All those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails.
Frank, you muted yourself.
Sorry about that. The motion prevails. We have House File 336 before us as amended, and you can proceed, Chair Becker Finn.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll just give you a brief overview for folks who aren't already familiar with this effort. So essentially, what we're trying to do is make it so that when people are having their driver's licenses suspended, that it isn't for reasons that have to do with actual public safety. What happens is that there are actually around 20,000 Minnesotans who have their driver's licenses suspended for things like failure to pay fines or failure to appear. And what that does, and this is where it gets really to the equity piece, is it's disproportionately making it so that people are not licensed and then they can't get to work, they can't live their lives and do things safely. And so what we know is that low-income folks are much more disproportionately impacted by the current system. And so what this bill does is some of those petty misdemeanor type things would no longer be reasons that people would have their driver's licenses suspended on their own. It is one of those bills public safety or in a judiciary committee in my committee, we do have a lot of issues like this where there is bipartisan agreement and it's not a hyper-partisan issue. But this in particular, we have support from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the State Bar, as well as the public defenders and many, many others. This is an ongoing effort by a broad group of people to get this moving forward. And really what the idea is to allow people to continue to drive legally so that they can continue to support their families so they can get to work safely without violating the law when their license is taken away for something that falls in that kind of petty misdemeanor level type of issue. I do have a couple testifiers and I would like to give more time to them if that's okay with the chair.
Yes, please, Chair Becker Finn, I think you have Mary Ellen Heng and Camille Bryant, if they could come forward and please state their names for our record and proceed with their testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Ellen Hang. I am the Deputy City Attorney of the Criminal Division in the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office. I have been a misdemeanor prosecutor for 23 years. And so I'm very familiar with the driving status offenses that we're talking about here, primarily driving after suspension. My office, and in conjunction with the St. Paul City Attorney's Office, we've partnered with them on this legislation in the past. We support this bill for a variety of reasons. For the past, just to give you a sense, my office in Minneapolis, we prosecute about 15,000 misdemeanor cases a year. So we have a hefty caseload. The last few years, our caseload numbers for driving after suspension have averaged around anywhere between 400 and 1,000 cases a year. And those are just the cases that come into court. There are hundreds, if not thousands, more citations where people don't set them for court that they're out there. This is simply not how I want my staff to be spending their time. As Chair Becker Finn said, we want to focus on cases that impact public safety. And for a lot of these cases, these drivers, while they're driving on a suspended license, they are pulled over because law enforcement runs their plate and sees that their license is suspended. They have not committed a traffic violation. They're driving safely within the rules. And other, but for the status of their license, they're not a public safety risk on the roads. And many of these individuals simply lack the resources to pay the fines, either within the prescribed time that causes them to be suspended. And so what we're not talking about is ending the suspension, or revocation rather, for people that are committing serious offenses like DWIs, driving without insurance, people that are repeat speeders. If you get enough petty misdemeanors, your license is revoked. We're not talking about people doing that type of behavior. Those fall in the public safety category that I want to spend my time on. What we're focusing on are individuals who simply cannot afford to pay their tickets, or at least pay them in bulk at the time the court wants them, and therefore they lose their privileges to drive simply because of their lack of finances. As you're all aware, the last 10 months have been very challenging for the court system, and we have essentially seen the court system shut down for the most part. And right now we're trying to recover, as is the whole world, from the pandemic and the impacts, and we're slowly opening the courts up, and we do not need to prioritize these type of cases. We have a backlog of domestic assaults, DWIs, other serious offenses. We need to come to court, and so the pandemic adds a new layer to this that we didn't have even last year when we were talking about this bill. And from my perspective as a prosecutor, having people out there with suspended licenses, it also means most likely they don't have insurance. And that is what makes it unsafe on the roads for our community members. We want licensed, insured drivers following the law on the roadways. And as Chair Becker Finn said, this often then leads to other unintended consequences that end up on my caseload. If they can no longer drive, maybe they lose their job. That leads them to lose their housing. And then we see them committing offenses such as trespassing, shoplifting, other things that are all tied into the larger issue. So I think this bill fits in really well with what we've been talking about for the last year and beyond, at least in Hennepin County for sure, the disparities in the system, how can we do better? And this is definitely one of them. And I know you're going to be talking about the fiscal note. The only other thing I'd like to add on that is I know that there will be a fiscal, you know, impact if these citations are no longer in the system. But my thought is we have to find a way to fund programs and departments without funding it on the backs of the individuals being cited. Law enforcement was criticized for writing tickets to fund their departments. This is really no different. And the courts need to be funded separately. DPS needs to be funded separately. To rely on reinstatement fees and court fines is not fair to the individuals. And when it's not right for law enforcement, it shouldn't be right in other situations. So thank you for considering this bill. We've been trying for several years to get it passed. I'm hoping this will be the year. But like I said, we're fully in support of this. And once Ms. Bryant has testified, I'm certainly willing to take any questions.
Thank you. I see Representative Petersburg's hand raised. Representative Petersburg, did you have a question for the testifier or for the author?
Final bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, good. All right, we'll call on you first, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you.
So we have two more testifiers that have signed up, Ms. Camille Bryant and Ishmael Dore. So if you all, Ms. Bryant, I'll call you first, and then welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Camille Bryant. I work as a public defender in Hennepin County. I've practiced as a public defender here for 13 years. In order to qualify for a public defender, a client must make no more than $15,613 a year if they're single, or $32,188 for a family of four. Based on the average incomes in Minneapolis, this includes PCAs, waitresses, janitors, grocer, and daycare workers. Those are my clients. To help put it in context, the average cost of rental housing in Minneapolis is roughly $19,000 per year. I have represented persons charged with felonies, but for the past 2 years, I've been representing people charged solely with misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. I normally have multiple clients with more than 10 unresolved driving after suspension cases. It's not unusual to see people with as many as 24 cases. I rarely have felony clients with a string of driving after suspension cases. I just didn't see them when I was doing felonies. For each of these cases, there's a fine, there's a late charge, there's a reinstatement fee, and if I have them as a client, there's a court surcharge for them having the services of a public defender. And until those charges are paid, clients can't get their license valid. The first question I get asked when I have a client in court is, are they valid? If they're not valid, they get referred to a program, DDP, driver diversion program, or another to help them get valid, which means at least an additional court appearance, often two or three, because of the backlog and the time it takes to get through the program. At least one of the driver's programs that's out there, Driving with Pride, actually leaves my clients worse off than they were if they had just paid the tickets on their own. When I look collectively at my clients' tickets and the corresponding police reports, common trends emerge. The first is that it's not unusual for multiple tickets to have been issued around the same time of day, on the same stretch of road, by the same police officer over a period of time. My clients that I have with those drivers after suspension cases are almost always Black men. And there are always stops that are initiated because the police ran their plates opposed to some additional driving behavior. These tickets set my clients on a set of indebtedness to the state. It puts them in the challenging position of knowingly breaking the law in order to drive to and from work or not to work or to have to change jobs or to have to find additional options for childcare. And it disproportionately affects Black men. My question to you is, are these the outcomes that you intend in these laws? And if they aren't, then the laws need to be changed.
Thank you, Ms. Bryant. Our next testifier is Ishmael Dore. And please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ishmael Dore. Today, I'm proud to be here as an organizer with the ACLU of Minnesota, but my journey here was difficult. I want to share my story so you'll know how important it is to end this hazardous practice. You see, I know the impact of excessive fines and fees and driver's license suspensions all too well. Several years ago, I got some traffic tickets, but I had no money to pay for them. I was experiencing my first phase of homelessness, trying to get on my feet to take another year of college, and I was living out of my 1999 Nissan Altima. And literally everything I owned was in my car. One day I parked my car in downtown Minneapolis. When I came back, it was gone. I found out the city had towed it. I continuously went down to the impound lot to get my car back, but the amount of money I owed went up every day. I wasn't allowed to retrieve any of my belongings. There was a deadline for me to get my car back, which I didn't know about. The day I finally made enough money to, get my car out of the impound lot, I found out that the city had sold it. I had reached the deadline. I lost my laptop, my birth certificate, my passport, all my clothes, plus stuff I could never replace, like art and jewelry that were gifts from family members in Africa. I was doing the best I could being homeless and living out of a car, but losing my car really put me in a state of desperation because now I really had nothing. The state, the things fell apart for me. I was flat broke. It was a cold Minnesota winter. Long story short, you know, I ended up incarcerated. And during that time is when I learned, like, officially that my license was suspended. I had my speculations, but during that time, I reached out to multiple counties to try to figure something out, really to pay off my fees concurrently, as I was already serving a debt to society. It only worked partially. Not all counties accepted my request, and I still ended up owing a lot. So after I was released, I didn't have money to start paying off traffic fines and fees. They weren't really a priority. You know, I'm fresh out trying to get my stuff together. I'm not thinking about paying fees from traffic tickets from years ago. I'm thinking about how am I going to get established. I knew I had to find a job, get some income, but by this time I was living in Little Canada, which is a suburb of St. Paul, and there's not much public transit out that way. And I, back against the wall, feeling stuck, I felt like to get to work, I felt as if I had no choice but to drive anyway. And in the long run, I just ended up with more tickets for driving with a suspended license than the initial number of traffic tickets that I even had to begin with. Now I'm on a payment plan. I got my license back. I'm paying those fines and fees plus reinstatement fees. There's also a special insurance, mind you, that the DVS will require you to purchase in order to even get your license back, which is also really expensive. It's called an SR-22. And all of this is costing me thousands of dollars. These state laws really need to be looked at. If a law doesn't benefit the community, it shouldn't be a law anymore. I believe judges should be allowed to waive fees, fines and fees on a case-by-case basis. The state definitely should stop suspending licenses because people can't pay for traffic tickets. Suspending licenses only creates more problems. It doesn't make someone pay their fines or fees any quicker. If they don't have money, it's just going to send them deeper into a deeper cycle of debt. It's time to give these people a second chance, really, especially those who are less fortunate, instead of being driven deeper into a cycle of, you know, poverty. And I know firsthand how hard it is to get out of that. And I'm still dealing with some of the effects to this day. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dore, for your powerful words and testimony. Very much appreciated. Members, I see Representative Heinrich and Representative Barr's hands are up. Did you have questions for the testifiers, or did you want to speak towards the end like Representative Petersburg? Happy to accommodate you either way.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinrich.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do have a question for Prosecutor Mary Ellen Hang.
You can proceed, Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to all the testifiers. I just thought this one would be good question for the prosecutor. Just more of out of curiosity, what is the threshold, like, for example, on for miles per hour over the speed limit where it does trigger that mandatory court date? Maybe that specific, or what on the road? I know DWI would probably be a mandatory in front of the judge. But at what point does this affect any of those? Like, if you have to show up before a judge, if that's a part of that citation, and then you don't show up for a judge, can you still get a revocation or a suspension at that point? I guess that's my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich. Ms. Hang.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, that's a great question. As far as the speeding, the officer has discretion based on the amount that you're traveling over the speed limit. They can cite you for speeding and then cite you for the miles per hour over. And those are petty misdemeanors that are what we call payable offenses. You're not required to come to court on those. And what happens is if you don't respond to that citation, any petty misdemeanor moving violation, if you fail to respond, what happens now are two things. that at ultimately after a certain period of time, a conviction is going to be entered on that offense, and then it's going to be certified to your driving record. So it will impact your driving record, and eventually, if you have enough moving violations in a certain amount of time, you will be revoked for your bad driving behavior. Right now, the other impact is that fine needs to be paid, and then it also adds that additional layer of if you don't pay off the fine associated with that ticket, you will also be suspended. You can have your status both revoked and suspended, even canceled, all at the same time for different instances. So this wouldn't impact that. What I have seen in my experience is when individuals are traveling, usually 30 plus more over the speed limit, the troopers, usually it's troopers on the freeways, we see the speed, but they often will check the endanger box on the citation or cite them for careless driving. Once an officer does either of those things, it requires a mandatory court appearance. And it turns that into a case where you have to come and you have to see me as a prosecutor to resolve your case and a judge. And so that won't be changed by this offense.
Thank you, Ms. Heng. Representative Barr, did you have a question for the testifiers or the author at this point?
Mr. Chair, I had a question for Ms. Bryant.
Okay, Ms. Bryant, if you can proceed, Representative Barr.
Ms. Bryant, during your testimony, you mentioned that some of the people who have been had their license suspended, they're on their way to work, and they'll get continually pulled over for having a plate run. How would an officer know? I mean, I'm thinking of the, like in the case of a seatbelt, that went from a non, what do they call it, a primary offense, you couldn't stop for it, stop somebody if you, even if you saw them, to a primary offense, we changed that. So if you see a car going down the highway and you're running the license plate, you're reading the license plate, not watching who's sitting in the driver's seat, who do you actually know who's driving it? If the car didn't make any problems, it's the driver that's driving without a suspended license. So just pulling a car over because that particular plate happens to, I mean, they could have loaned it to their friend. There's nothing wrong, nothing saying you can't loan your car out. So I'm trying to follow along with that. Could you help me out a little bit, please?
Ms. Bryant.
Well, you're actually absolutely right. That's what the law says, that they can't stop unless they believe that there is the person who matches the description of the registered license driver. But that's a matter of what gets put in the police report. You know, when they fill out the police report, that's what's indicated. And those are challenges that we would have to make on a case-by-case basis. When we get clients in with 24 driving after suspension, we do have the option of going through and selectively legally challenging them. But in terms of efficiency, it tends to work out better for our clients to negotiate them away. But you're right, we would have the option of going through each and every single driving after suspension case to challenge the stop when they're running the plates, because they just run the plates. But that's another avenue where these cases, if we were litigating them to the fullest, would clog up our judicial system and would cause even more resources to go towards them and take even longer, especially for our clients who are working really hard their licenses back in order to get a job. I had a client a couple of weeks ago who had been going to get his real estate license, and he couldn't use the real estate license because he didn't have a valid driver's license. Like, they were pieces of the program that required it. And so for him, what was most important is, let's hurry up and get this done, because I don't have time to keep coming back to court. I don't have time to go for a trial, even if I think that the police were inappropriate in stopping me, because he's trying to live his life.
Thank you. Do you have a very quick follow-up, Representative Barr? We want to get to the fiscal note conversation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Bryant, could you just contact me? I'd like to talk more about that offline, please.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Appreciate
Chair.
Appreciate that. Members, we have a fiscal note for this bill, and it's a little different than previous fiscal notes related to this. And of course, we have new members, and maybe the previous members may not recall the fiscal piece of this bill. So I'm going to call on Mr. Lee from House Fiscal Analyst for the Transportation Committee to very briefly explain the fiscal note, and he can entertain any questions for members about it. Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, for the record, my name is Andrew Lee from House Fiscal Staff. Fiscal notes are prepared by the executive branch. So in this case, the agency that has relevance to the Transportation Committee is the Department of Public Safety. And a fiscal note is an estimate of the potential impact of proposed legislation. So if members could turn to, they should have received a fiscal note in the committee packet. I'll give you a second to look for that. But there's two pieces of this fiscal note, one that applies to the Department of Public Safety and one that applies to the Supreme Court. The Department of Public Safety is within the committee's purview, so I'll be talking about that section. There's two pieces of this fiscal note. If you go to the second page when you have a chance, there is an estimated fee revenue loss and then an expenditure by the Department of Public Safety. The fee revenue loss applies to the general fund and the driver and vehicle services, vehicle service account of the special revenue fund. So very briefly, if you go down to page four, the Department of Public Safety lays out their assumptions for how they estimate the fee loss as a result of fines not being paid for the failure to appear or driving while suspended or driving while revoked fees. Those assumptions are on page four and page five. And loss of general fund revenue as a result of the estimated loss of general fund revenue would be about $324,000 a year from the general fund starting in FY 2022 and about $208,000 to $218,000 to the driver services account. There's also a very small agency expenditure to comply with the law, and that is detailed on the bottom of page five. Essentially, the agency estimates that they would need some programming costs for the driver services system, which would cost about $56,000. And they believe that they can do that cost with existing appropriations, so they're not requesting an appropriation for that. An additional approximately $9,700 for mailing out notices that essentially people would be eligible for license reinstatement. And then the next few pages are an explanation of the Supreme Court portion of the note, but I'll leave it there in case members have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. And members, you know, this bill will wind up, it's traveling separately as of now. It will go to the Ways and Means Committee. It will be held there until we get a target or transportation later on in March, because you know, this does have that general fund impact. So we have, I think, four or five members of this committee on Ways and Means, so that will be discussed there. Are there any questions of Mr. Lee? Let me see here.
I can ask the question of him,
okay,
Mr. Chair.
I see Representative Mason. Very quickly, Representative Mason, because we'd like to get to a vote, and Representative Petersburg, I will allow, if you wanted to make some final comments. Representative Mason. You're muted, Representative Mason. There you go. Okay, we can hear you now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee, I just want to clarify. So that agency is counting on money from people to that will get tickets. It's not something that they really are entitled to or normally would get, but they're banking that people are going to disobey or get tickets. Am I understanding that right?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Petersburg, would you like to make any closing comments or have a question?
Yeah, one quick comment and then the question of Mr. Lee. Just coincidentally, our daughter was coming to pick up her grandson at our apartment complex. I stay up here at St. Paul, and she was involved with an accident from an individual that had no driver's license and no insurance. Probably an indicator that it was very similar to what we're talking about today. My question to Mr. Lee is that on page five of those assumptions, there were two concerns that they have. I believe the amendment that we have took care of at least one of those. Did it take care of the one in regards to the federal CDL license interactions? Because I think that's dealt with by federal law as well. So was that excluded with this amendment as well, if you know that answer?
Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, I think I might want to defer to either my colleague Matt Burris at House Research or the Department of Public Safety for that question.
Yeah, I saw Mr. Burris pop in here, so you can unmute Mr. Burris, and I'd love to hear your perspective on this.
Mr. Chair and members, Matt Burris with House Research. That second issue regarding disqualifications for commercial driver's license holders is not addressed by the amendment. There have been some additional conversations at the staff level and with Representative Becker Finn and DPS. So that's a piece that's in progress, I guess you might say.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. And I know Chair Becker Finn, you have your hand up, and if you wanted to make any closing comments or if you had a question of staff, I don't know if you wanted to proceed now or just at the end.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And on the CDL piece, there's we're working that out. It was something that was brought up late, and I can commit to members that will continue to make sure, you know, that's obviously not the intent to screw up anything else, and is, you know, part of the committee process to make sure we're getting this right. You know, as far as the fiscal note, I do want to note that this bill gets to the broader impact of criminalizing behavior that doesn't actually impact public safety. And what happens is when we get folks on this path, you know, the greater actual economic cost to individual people and families and our state, when people get on this path to, you know, multiple contacts with the system and losing housing and their jobs and everything like that, that I know those are not things that are contemplated always in fiscal notes, but I think it's a very important part of this conversation and sort of the value of moving this piece of legislation forward. So thank all the members who've already signed on in support, and we'll continue to work to make sure this bill is as good as it can be.
Thank you. And Representative, thank you so much for that, Chair Becker Finn. Representative Petersburg, just wanted to make sure that your concern or question about the CDLs was answered.
No, I just, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that it got addressed before it goes on to the next level. I know it has to make a couple of stops, so I trust I just was bringing up, make sure that we didn't miss it. And I think that the bill is worthy of its passage. I know of so many people that say once their license is revoked, they have no consequence to really keep driving. So this is important for us to have somebody that can also have insurance as well. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any other comments, Chair Becker Finn? And then we'll proceed to take a roll call vote as required by rule on this bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thank you for hearing the bill and thank folks for their questions. It's incredibly important to many, many Minnesotans, and I appreciate members' support.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. So members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 336 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance and Policy. Mr. Dodge, if you will take the roll.
Chair Hornstein?
Hornstein votes aye. Mr. Dodge, we're having a little trouble hearing you. I don't know if you can adjust your audio for the roll call, please.
Is this better, Mr. Chair?
Much better. Okay, so why don't we start, take it from the top, Mr. Dodge.
Okay, Chair Hornstein.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Petersburg.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Representative Bernardi.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Hausman.
Aye.
Representative Heinrich.
Aye.
Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Murphy.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Representative Torkelson.
Aye.
Representative West.
Aye.
There are 17 ayes and 0 nays.
Thank you, Mr. Dodge, and thank you very much, Chair Becker-Finn. You are now on your way to Public Safety, Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy, and we wish you good luck with your bill and appreciate your testifiers and your work on this very important bill. Members, we will be reconvening on Tuesday at our usual time. We'll have a presentation on climate and transportation. And then a week from today, we'll be hearing a number of bills that are, you know, several different bills, including from our own committee member, Representative Petersburg, and then a couple from Representative Elkins, and then other members. So be prepared a week from today to hear a number of bills and then talk about transportation and climate and clean cars on Tuesday. With that, members, this meeting is adjourned.